Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the U.S. State Department, who assesses the current lightning advance of ISIS insurgents across Iraq and the advisability of U.S. military intervention there. Andrea James, co-founder and director of the group Families for Justice as Healing, who talks about the origins of her organization and the demands of the June 21st Free Her Prison Reform protest rally in Washington, D.C. And Rachel Tabachnik of Political Research Associates, who discusses the danger posed by extremist anti-government groups and the support they receive from both Republican politicians and right-wing media. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An investigation by The Guardian newspaper identified hundreds of people working in slave conditions on fishing boats in Thailand. The Thai fishing fleets are an important part of the global system supplying shrimp to U.S. big-box supermarkets like Walmart and Costco and French retailers Carrefour and Tesco. The Guardian linked the slaves aboard Thai fishing boats with the Thailand-based company Charon Pokapan, or CP Foods, the world's largest shrimp supplier. Men who escaped from the fishing boats told stories of horrific conditions, including 20-hour workdays, beatings, torture, and murder. For years, advocacy groups and the International Labor Organization have detailed allegations of slavery involving Thai fishing boats. But now, for the first time, The Guardian has connected the slavery on the fishing boats to global retailers like Walmart. In response to the report, French supermarket giant Carrefour has suspended purchases from CP Foods and launched an audit of its global supply chain, while other supermarket chains are debating further action. When hydraulic fracturing, or fracking oil and gas drilling operations, ramped up along the Bennett Shale in northern Texas, neighbors started complaining to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality about nausea, rashes, and nosebleeds. Frustrated by the lack of action by the Texas Commission, Liss and Bob Parr went to state court and won a $3 million judgment against the Aruba Petroleum Company from a jury who concluded that toxic emissions from oil and gas drilling had sickened local residents. Aruba Petroleum has requested the trial judge to overturn the jury verdict. Attorney Tomas Ramirez, who is pressing a similar case in South Texas, told the Center for Public Integrity, "This case will be looked at very, very closely because it has set the stage in a way that has never been set before." Elin Levin, an Austin-based lawyer with the Environmental Integrity Project, a research and advocacy organization, worries that instead of being a wake-up call for regulatory change, the Parr's case could lead state officials and lawmakers to find ways to block citizens from winning similar lawsuits. Texas has a long reputation of being extremely pro-business, said Robert Percival with the University of Maryland's Environmental Law Program. The message from all parts of the state, including the regulatory agencies, is one of full speed ahead without being sensitive to the concerns of the public. Vermont Independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders is testing the waters for a possible progressive presidential campaign in 2016. Already, Sanders has made several speaking trips to Iowa, the first in the nation presidential caucus state. Progressive activists inside both the Democratic and Green parties are campaigning separately to convince Sanders to run for the White House in 2016. If Sanders, who will be 75 on Election Day 2016, decides to run, he'll have to choose between becoming a candidate in the Democratic primaries or running as an independent. Progressive Democrats of America's Connor Boylan told the news magazine In These Times, "If Hillary Clinton does run in the primaries, you're going to see two visions of America, the more corporate, neoliberal Hillary Clinton and the more populist, fighting for the middle class Bernie Sanders. That is why having the two of them in a debate is worth its weight in gold for progressive Democrats." But North Carolina Green Party activist Michael Trudeau says there is no room inside the centrist Democratic Party for Sanders to run a viable campaign for the presidency. Ralph Nader, who has run several independent campaigns for president, says Bernie Sanders ought to run as a Democrat for the White House. Nader quipped, "I think he's history if he runs as an independent. He'll go nowhere." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The current military offensive and successful advance by Sunni insurgents of ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, capturing major cities across northern and central Iraq, has stunned governments across the globe and called into question the viability of the Iraqi state. ISIS fighters, a breakaway faction of al-Qaeda in Iraq, have captured key Iraqi cities including Mosul, Tikrit, Ramadi, Fallujah, and Tal Afar, facing little or no resistance from the Iraqi army. In their wake, the militants have reportedly carried out mass executions of hundreds or possibly more than 1,000 soldiers and civilians. As ISIS forces move toward the Iraqi capital of Baghdad, alarmed politicians in Washington are looking to assign blame for what appears to be the near collapse of the U.S.-installed Iraqi government. However, many observers say the current crisis can be linked to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's policies that failed to unite the country and fueled religious hatred between the majority Shia and minority Sunni population. President Obama is considering taking military action in Iraq, including drone strikes, in support of the Iraqi army. Although the U.S. and Iran are on opposite sides in Syria's civil war, Washington and Tehran are reportedly now discussing ways to work together to shore up the Iraqi state. Your reporter spoke with Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the U.S. State Department who served in Iraq during the war, and author of the book titled We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Here, Van Buren assesses the lightning advance of ISIS insurgents and the advisability of U.S. military intervention in the current crisis.
What we're seeing in Iraq now and Syria, as well as other parts of the Mideast, is an inevitable response to the invasion of 2003. In 2003, the Middle East existed in a very uneasy but still working balance of power. Saddam in Iraq was a Sunni by name, but essentially a powerful secular leader who held together Iraq's three ethnic groups by force, using his secret police and the national security state to keep the minority Sunnis in power, the majority Shias in check, and the very powerful Kurds organized, but not too organized, close, but not too close. That had gone on for some years until the United States arrived and destroyed literally overnight civil society in Iraq, as well as disbanding the police, the army, the garbage collectors, the people who ran the telephone and the water systems, and everything else, right down to school teachers. That period of chaos in Iraq let loose the dragons that Saddam had kept in check, albeit through hard violence. Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds went for each other's throats. Over a period of almost 9 years of occupation, the United States failed to effectively deal with this. It was the gorilla in the room, if not the room that dominated the guerrilla. It was everything that was going on in Iraq, every roadside bomb, every soldier that was killed, every setback was because of this inherent tension and inherent conflict that we had unleashed and failed to succeed in putting back into the bottle, if you will. That is why we're seeing what we're seeing today in Iraq.
What is your view of the calls now, especially from certain sectors of the Republican Party? John McCain, Lindsey Graham, those senators are calling out Barack Obama for not stepping up to take military action that they believe is necessary to address this crisis in Iraq. And Lindsey Graham and others talk about that if the U.S. does not act, that Iraq will become the staging ground for the next 9/11 terrorist attack. What do you make of these calls for military action?
Well, not to start off tritely, but of course, Lindsey Graham and John McCain call for airstrikes every time someone sneezes in the Middle East. And so this is nothing new, but the same posturing and pseudo-macho rambling that we see from there. The short answer is that if the full force of the United States, $2 trillion in expenditures, the entire U.S. Army, and 9 years failed to solve the problems in Iraq, it is highly unlikely that some form of airstrikes or drone strikes or special forces can really do anything particularly significant. Airstrikes or any kind of military intervention is simply a continuation of the mistakes that we have been making continuously since 2006, primarily supporting one side in a triangular conflict, Sunni Shia Kurd. The United States helped install Prime Minister Maliki, the guy who runs Iraq, or thinks he runs Iraq right now, in 2006 under very shaky circumstances. In the elections of 2010, which I was present for and worked on as part of the U.S. Department of State, Maliki did not win the elections, but the United States stepped back and allowed the Iranians to broker a compromise solution that put Maliki in power. Prime Minister Maliki almost immediately began punishing the Sunnis around him and, to the best of his ability, ignoring the Kurds north of him. And the United States, for the 4 years since the troops left, has been supporting Prime Minister Maliki in these actions. Continued support of him by airstrikes, if you will do nothing more but dig the hole deeper. The first rule of hole digging is, when you're in too deep, stop digging.
Peter, I wanted to ask you about partition. Not that long ago, Senator Joe Biden and others were talking about partitioning Iraq into three sections, one for the Kurds, a section for the Sunnis, and the southern part of the country for the Shia. Is this any kind of solution, or is there some kind of a priority to keeping the state of Iraq unified?
The state of Iraq should be written always in quotes, because it is an artificial construct that the British drew literally on maps following World War One. What we're seeing now is the process of the Middle East attempting to recreate itself along the proper regional, ethnic, religious, tribal, military, et cetera, borders. Breaking Iraq, or allowing Iraq to naturally separate into three states, was certainly a viable option in 2003, 4, 5-ish, somewhere in there, when the three groups would have likely been willing to accept a separation, and the United States Army could have enforced that by creating a buffer zone, basically putting itself in between the three conflicting forces long enough and forcefully enough to cause them to create natural boundaries that they could live with. I think that's what's going to happen in the long term in Iraq, whether we want it to happen or whether we help it happen or don't help it happen. The problem is that the separation that will occur now will be long, and it will be violent, and it will not favor the interests of the United States. It's too much right now, in my opinion, to have it break into three states in any kind of peaceful way. Anything the United States continues to do in Iraq may postpone the inevitable, but it can't stop it.
That was Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the U.S. State Department who served in Iraq during the war. He's author of the book titled We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Find links to Van Buren's articles on Iraq and additional analysis and commentary about the current conflict on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On June 21st, thousands of people are expected at a rally in Washington, D.C. that will highlight the situation of women in prison and call for an end to the war on drugs. The rally, called Free Her, points to the faster rate of incarceration for women over men, although men still make up the vast majority of the 2.5 million Americans in prison. Most of those women were prosecuted for nonviolent drug offenses, taking them away from their children, or in some cases forcing women to give birth while in prison. For other women, decades-long prison sentences mean that many can never have children. More women than men have suffered either physical or sexual abuse before being jailed, and they suffer higher rates of mental illness while incarcerated, where very few receive adequate mental health care. Andrea James is a former lawyer who served 2 years at Danbury Federal Prison for wire fraud. She left behind a 12-year-old daughter and a 5-month-old son. While at Danbury, she and a few other women inmates founded a group called Families for Justice as Healing, and she now serves as the director of the Boston-based group, which is the prime organizer of the Free Her Rally. The protest is being organized by formerly incarcerated women on behalf of the women they left behind. James says the demands of the rally include an end to voter disenfranchisement for people with felony convictions, asking President Obama to commute the sentences of women and men in the federal system who have applied for such status, and calling for support for the Smarter Sentencing Act, legislation which would reduce the number of mandatory minimum sentences and take another step toward equalizing penalties for crack and powder cocaine. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Andrea James about the origins of her group, Families for Justice as Healing, and the goals of the June 21st Free Her Rally in Washington, D.C.
We started our organization in the prison yard in Danbury, and we started it to mostly raise awareness of the increase in incarceration of women in this country. Women are the fastest growing population of incarcerated people right now, and we've had a 400% increase in incarceration of women in the United States and 800% for African-American women, which is extraordinarily alarming. And it's in relation mostly to the war on drugs. We started the organization as incarcerated women to use our voices to really paint a more accurate portrait of who is incarcerated. Who are these women and what kind of impact their incarceration has had on their children and on the communities that they come from?
You said a Native American woman who was also incarcerated at Danbury gave you a book when she left that really made an impression on you.
The title of the book was Justice as Healing. And it was a book written by a prosecutor in Canada who talked about the Native way of addressing issues that we refer to as criminal justice issues here in the United States. And the way that they addressed those issues was to start with the person, start with who that person is, and really putting the offense that the person committed off the table and just beginning to work with the person, reminding them about the value and how important they are and what impact they've had on the lives of other people, and really beginning a process of justice as healing. Anytime when you're talking about this population where many people are suffering from chronic poverty, where people are suffering from issues of addiction, and in terms of women, when we look at the statistics, women who have had, you know, lifetime histories of sexual abuse or domestic violence, chronic poverty, substance abuse, when we look at those issues, then healing is what we need to do to help people. Prison doesn't provide for that in any way. It's not a place to expect people to begin to heal. And prisons are extraordinarily dehumanizing places. They are places that create complete exhaustion in the person who is there. And particularly for the population of women who are mostly nonviolent offenders, who are warehoused, underprotected in our country.
Andrea James, what are your demands for the rally on June 21st?
So the three reasons why we're convening on the Washington Mall on June 21st is the first one, as I've mentioned, is to raise awareness of the increase of incarceration of women in the United States, the impact on our children and our communities. The second reason is to encourage President Obama to commute the sentences of women serving nonviolent drug offenses in the federal system, which is something that the Justice Department on April 23rd finally came out and said they are willing to do, not just for women, but for people in the federal system serving nonviolent drug sentences and other sentences. The president will be ramping up the commutation efforts to give consideration to people who fit into 6 criteria. Now, one of those criteria is particularly harsh from our perspective, and that is that you have to have already served 10 years. Because for 2 years now, our organization has been pushing and advocating for commutation for women in the federal system who have 4 years in, 5 years in, 6 years in, 7 years in, 8 years in. You know, 10 years is still too long. 10 years is a really long time. And we shouldn't now put a mandatory minimum on commutation consideration where one didn't exist before. The third reason why we're coming is a two-part reason in terms of legislation that's pending right now. One is the Smarter Sentencing Act. We're coming to raise support and to ask people just in general across the country to call your congresspeople in support of the Smarter Sentencing Act. And in addition to that, the Barber Amendment. The Barber Amendment will restore federal parole. We lost federal parole when they introduced mandatory minimums to the federal system. And we also lost good time, federal good time, when we introduced mandatory minimums. And we also lost federal parole. So those are two things that we really need to push forward, the Smarter Sentencing Act and the Barber Amendment. And we're coming to raise awareness of those and to get people across the country to call in support of those things.
That was Andrea James, co-founder and director of the group Families for Justice as Healing. For more information on the organization and their June 21st Free Her protest rally, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On June 8th, the nation witnessed yet another violent incident inspired by anti-government and right-wing hate ideology, this time in Las Vegas, Nevada. Jared Miller and his wife Amanda, originally from Indiana, shot and killed two police officers at a pizzeria as they ate lunch. They draped the Gadsden flag, adopted by the Tea Party movement reading Don't Tread on Me, over one of the bodies, placed a Nazi swastika on top of the flag, and pinned a note to the other officer's body reading, "This is the start of the revolution." They went on to kill an armed shopper at a nearby Walmart store who had tried to stop the couple. Jared was later killed by police, after which his wife committed suicide using her own gun. The Millers, who had espoused anti-government and white supremacist views, had traveled to the Bunkerville, Nevada cattle ranch of Clive and Bundy in mid-April to offer armed support to the rancher as he faced off with officers of the Federal Bureau of Land Management over two decades of non-payment of grazing fees. The Bundy family says they asked the couple to leave the ranch because of their criminal history. The Millers' murder of three in Las Vegas and their involvement in the confrontation at the Bundy Ranch followed the April 13th slaying of three people at a Jewish community center and an assisted living facility in Overland Park, Kansas. Those murders were allegedly committed by former Grand Dragon of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, Frazier Glenn Miller. Your reporter spoke with Rachel Tabachnik, a fellow at the Boston-based social justice think tank Political Research Associates, who discusses the danger posed by extremist anti-government groups and the support they receive from both conservative Republican politicians and right-wing media.
Well, of course, this very brutal violence was an outlier, but the sentiment behind it, the idea that that police are the threat and that government is the threat, and then there must be a revolution against particularly federal government, is becoming quite widespread. And in fact, we are seeing this kind of rhetoric in places perhaps that we've not seen it before. We had a wave of this in the 1990s during the Clinton administration. And of course, the very well-known incidents at Ruby Ridge and at Waco, resulting in a lot of anti-government rhetoric and violence. But what we're seeing today is interesting, and that the rhetoric has spread through much of the religious right, through the Tea Party activity, and also into county governments, including county sheriffs. One of the things that was curious about, or tragic, about this brutal killing is we also found out that this couple had participated in the Clive and Bundy Ranch event in April, where Bundy and various militia groups and Oath Keepers had a standoff with the Bureau of Land Management in Nevada. And one of the groups that was involved there, in addition to Oath Keepers, is something called the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. So one of the things that we see happening is where there were very few law enforcement involved, say, in the 1990s participation with militia groups. Today, we are seeing this expand to rather substantial groups of sheriffs getting involved in this anti-government rhetoric and organizing.
What kind of threat do you think this represents to the country, Rachel? And what is the best way for the government or people at large to respond to these folks who are walking around with guns, threatening law enforcement officers, and generally trying to intimidate people who are elected officials and otherwise represent elected government?
Well, I think it needs to be taken very seriously by the public. And when there are incidents of extreme violence, like this killing that took place by this couple, it should not be dismissed as just crazy or insanity. We need to be taking seriously this rise in anti-government sentiment, many of the conspiracy theories. You may recall several years ago there was a murder by Richard Poplawski, three police officers in Pittsburgh, which was another very tragic example of belief in conspiracy theories that the government is coming to get you, coming to get your guns, coming to put you in a FEMA concentration camp, these type of conspiracy theories. And again, this is something that's becoming quite widespread and not terribly uncommon, and not just among groups of militias and camouflage, you know, training in the woods somewhere, but becoming more part of everyday American life.
Rachel, in your mind, what is the responsibility of some conservative politicians that we see at the state and federal level who articulate support for these anti-government groups, even those who are armed and threaten law enforcement officials with violence?
Well, I think these politicians do bear some responsibility in the escalation of the rhetoric. If you look, for example, when the Bundy standoff was going on, there were quite a few politicians who spoke very approvingly of Bundy and what he was doing. So I think these politicians do bear responsibility. We also saw a great deal of press and punditry in support of Bundy and what he was doing, right up until the point where he began making extreme racist comments. Then many of those politicians backed away. So there is a need to look more deeply at what is driving the narratives that are driving anti-government violence, and to be more responsible in response to those.
That was Rachel Tabachnik, a fellow at the Boston-based social justice think tank, Political Research Associates. For more news and analysis of America's right-wing patriot and militia movements, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Evan Beter, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.